Good afternoon and welcome to the second October meeting of the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations, coming to you today from Erickson Hall on the coast of Maine, Northport, Maine. A particular welcome to our public radio audience, reaching us through the good offices of Maine Public Broadcasting Network, MPBN. I'm Tom DeMarco, filling in for Mac DeFord. Mac is away at the moment. He's president of the forum. We were founded in 1983. The forum is now celebrating more than 30 years of bringing you on a monthly basis informed speakers on all aspects of foreign affairs, U.S. diplomatic policy, and often the lack thereof. Details about past and upcoming speakers and programs are available on our website at midcoastforum.org. The forum is very pleased today to be able to bring you Shibley Telhami, the Anwar Sadat Professor of Peace and Development at the University of Maryland at College Park. I told Shibley last night, we had dinner last night with members of the board, that he was the most cited of the speakers who's come through here. By that I mean more of our past speakers, the ones that spoke on the Middle East, mentioned his name or cited him as a reference or an opinion that they had derived from Shibley Telhami. I started to make a list, so many people mentioned him. But in particular, if you were here in last month, Rania Abu Zaid in her presentation cited Shibley Telhami, as had John Mearsheimer a few months before, Juan Cole, Gregory Johnson, who spoke on Yemen. And I used to think, as I made my little list, this guy's name keeps cropping up, I used to think, well, he's just a commentator on the Middle East, and they are themselves commentators and analysts on the Middle East, and he's just one that is particularly respected by his peers. But the story is a little deeper than that. Shibley has made his life's work over the past more than a decade to build a statistical profile of the Arab mind. He does that by sending teams of very carefully trained researchers out into all of the Arab countries to learn what's going on in people's minds through face-to-face interviews. And so he is the source of all kinds of information you hear glibly cited over the without any citation to him over the radio. When Deb Amos tells you that the Arab street is thinking such and such, how does she know that? When a typical reporter from NPR says, well, the attitude in Mosul is this, while the people in the south think that. It's not that he's been there. He's hunkered down in the green zone. It's Shibley Telhami that's provided all the data. So he has given us the most complete. It's a unique niche he's carved for himself, because next to nobody else is doing this, a unique look at what the Arab mind is thinking. And he has presented that most recently in a book called The World Through Arab Eyes, which I picked up a copy of this morning. It's on sale outside or for our radio audience available through a bookstore near you, i.e. Amazon. Shibley, thank you for braving the last days of Maine's Indian summer. Welcome, Shibley Telhami.
Thanks very much. Well, thanks very much. It's really a pleasure and honor for me to be here, and what a beautiful fall day. I didn't know what I was going to expect this time of the year in Maine, but it's even more magnificent than I expected. I'm going to focus my remarks on just giving you a perspective, an interpretation on what is going on in the Middle East. I mean, we see all these amazing events that we've been facing since 2010, and they've swept much of the Arab world, you know, from Libya to Egypt to Syria, Iraq, Yemen, Bahrain, and we still are facing them in a big way. And America, which said, we're going to get out of the Middle East, we're going back in. It's really interesting to see that a president who really wanted to reach out to the Muslim world, a president who wanted to engage from the war in Iraq and Iran, a president who in his first year won the Nobel Peace Prize, just started bombing the seventh Muslim country. So it tells you something really unusual about that mix that is taking place. So I'd like to give you an interpretation of what I think is going on, but I welcome questions beyond my presentation. This is a region I follow from many different angles, both the politics of the region, the society of the region, its relations with the rest of the world, American foreign policy toward the region, the Israel-Palestine question that I follow very closely. I will not address that head on, but I certainly follow that very closely and also do public opinion polls there. About our own public, I do public opinion in the U.S. about where the American public is on issues related to the Middle East, and certainly on local issues like Egypt, what's happening in Egypt. Much of that I will not address in my formal presentation. I invite questions from the audience on this, and I'm happy to address it. But I will instead make these broader remarks. And let me give you, first of all, my sense of the big issues that have combined to create this explosive environment that we're witnessing in the Middle East. And I think there are principally two, and I think I will add a third, that I think will add to the mix in the coming months and years. The first is the consequences of the Iraq War in 2003. The second is the rise of the Arab uprisings. And the third is that we're coming to the end of the road on the path to a two-state solution onto the Israel-Palestine conflict that has been really the aim of diplomacy globally and for the U.S. And so what I'd like to do is revisit those issues to tell you why these issues have been so devastating. And I know that many of you may have had different views on the 2003 Iraq War, whether it was necessary or unnecessary, whether it flowed logically from the attack on our soil at 9/11 or not. But regardless, there have been consequences that we're still living with, and they are far worse than you think. They are far worse than you think, and I know many of you think they've been bad. And I'd like to revisit those to just underline how horrifically bad these consequences are, how ISIS is first and foremost a product of the Iraq War, not of the Arab uprising, and why, in combination with the Arab uprisings, we have this additional explosive mix. So let me start with the Iraq War. Now, the first thing is, look, Iraq was ruled by a dictator, ruthless dictator. We tried to contain him. We did. We fought him a couple of times. But Iraq did not have terrorist group on its soil, and certainly Al-Qaeda wasn't there. And those of us who opposed the Iraq War very much said, as I did in my book in 2002 and 2003, reprinted in 2003, The Stakes, America and the Middle East, that the immediate consequence will be that you're going to have the collapse of central authority, which is going to create home in the Arab world for non-state actors like Al-Qaeda and its allies. And those are going to expand. Because when you have a collapse of central authority, it's very difficult to replace it. We had the power to reshuffle the deck in the Middle East, but we didn't have the power to determine where the cards will fall. And we still don't, no matter how powerful we are. And for that reason, the minute you unravel a state as complex as Iraq that took decades to put together in the first place, you're going to have inevitably these transnational groups that are going to find refuge there, and they're going to operate from there, and they're going to destabilize not only Iraq but its region. So the first consequence is, yes, these groups have found home. Yes, Al-Qaeda has found home. And yes, we can't easily dislodge it. Second, we had the revival and intensification of sectarianism as a consequence of that war. Now, I have to tell you something that we always think that sectarianism is the cause. I mean, sure, there's Sunni and Shia divide. This is a favorite thing for us now. It's an easy thing to point to and say, well, Muslims are divided among Sunnis and Shias. Well, guess what? They've always been divided as Sunnis and Shias from the very inception of Islam. This is about very early succession. This is not new. This is not something that is, can explain. Look at the variation in the history of Islam. Look at the variation in the history of the Middle East over the centuries. This is not what explains why we sometimes have peace, why we sometimes don't. Why we sometimes have sectarianism being a major factor, so why we sometimes don't. And the fact that people could feel that they're Shia or Sunni, or Christian for that matter, Arabs, many Arabs are Christian, is not a function necessarily of what they embrace most at any given time. We all have complex identities. An Arab is an Arab, and a Muslim or a Christian, a Sunni or a Shia, an Iraqi or a Lebanese, a citizen of the world. Everybody has multiple identities. Everybody has complex identities. Each one of us does. Whether you feel like your identity is with Maine or with the United States, whether you're a faithful believer or you have something else. The question is, which identity do you embrace most at any given time? And sectarianism rises when alternatives diminish. So when there is no Iraq, when there's no central authority you can relate to, when there's no one protecting you from central authority, when there's no one providing you food from central authority, how could you identify with that abstract Iraq anymore? So the very fact that we have the rise of sectarianism as the choice of people and their identity is a function of the collapse of the state itself. It's an outcome, not a cause. And we need to understand that, and we have a lot of data that supports that. And by the way, you know, we use this Shia and Sunni terminology very loosely. We say ISIS is attacking the Kurds. Well, guess what? Most of the Kurds are Sunni, by the way, just in case you haven't realized. And if you look at Sunnis who mobilized for jihad back in the 1980s, what you discover is most of them were inspired by the Ayatollah Khomeini in Iran, who was Shia. And if you look at my polls in the Arab world, in Sunni countries like Egypt and Jordan and Morocco in 2006 and 2007, just less than 10 years ago, and I'm asking these Sunni populations, name the leader that you admire most in the world, and they name Hassan Nasrallah, the Shia leader of Hezbollah, as the man they admired most at that time. That is not an indication that the Sunni-Shia divide is necessarily mobilizing them. Don't get me wrong, there is a Sunni-Shia divide. We have sectarianism now. And in part because people go to these loyalties that are going to serve their interests, they're going to help them survive, that are going to help them eat. And part of it is tribalism, because tribes are sectarian by definition, and you rely on those who are closest to you. So sectarianism is a messy, messy problem that has come out, first and foremost, the dissolution of the state in Iraq. It is not the source of the problem, it is the outcome of the problem. And we need to understand that, because we shouldn't get our eyes off that ball we screwed up in that Iraq 2003 war. The third issue that has to do with that Iraq war is a major and destabilizing redistribution of state power in the Middle East that we didn't have before. You know, we the United States of America, always had interest in the region, certainly connected with oil and beyond oil. But even when the U.S. was either acting directly, positioning forces, or just balancing the Soviet Union in terms of the interest in the region, we always understood historically, dating back to the end of World War II, that we need to have a regional balance, because you can't do it all at the very top. And you need to have some regional balance to diminish the need for your intervention. And that was principally seeing Iraq and Iran as balancing each other. That you had two powerful states that competed with each other, that could help balance each other. And through that balance, you have a certain helper in the management of regional affairs. Whether we liked Saddam or liked the Iranians, it didn't matter that much. That was a function of everybody's perception of the system and managing that system. When we went to war, Iraq is no longer a power. You know, whether it'll come back as a state, a unified state or not, is another question altogether. But even if it does, Iraq is not a regional power right now. What did that do? That immediately raised the power of Iran. even regardless of its nuclear aspiration. Put that aside for a minute. And that redistribution of power is destabilizing and threatening to the weaker states. What does that mean? That means everyone then have a stake in what's happening in Iraq, and they want to intervene. And therefore, it invites international intervention. The Iranians want to reshape Iraq in a way that is conducive to their interests. The Saudis want to reshape Iraq in a way that's conducive to their interests. Everybody wants to intervene. And we have international intervention where you have state collapse in a way that we cannot at all understand the outcome in any given country without understanding that incredible layer of support that's coming from the outside. That's certainly true of Syria as well. With the dissolution of the state, I'll come back to it in a minute through the Arab uprisings, but with the dissolution of the state, there's no way you can understand what's happening in Syria by just referring to the sects in Syria, or just referring to the dictator regime opposed by the public, or then to the sectarian divide of Alawis and Sunnis and Christians and Druze, all of which are important and obviously add to the complexity. But a lot of the intervention in Syria cannot be understood without the external intervention, without the Shia Hezbollah intervening on behalf of Assad, without the money that came from the Gulf states to the opposition that is Sunni, without the Russian intervention on behalf of Assad, without our intervention in what's happening in Syria. So when you have a messy environment and it influences all your interests, global interests, regional interests, everyone wants to intervene in a way that makes it harder and harder to resolve the question. These places become arenas for strategic competition for everybody else. They're not just domestic issues, they're far more complicated. The fourth element that I want to talk about is anti-Americanism. One of the problems that we face now in the Middle East and have faced since is that we do have a very angry public sentiment with American foreign policy. Now, to be fair, this has endured over time. This is not something particularly new. It has been, sometimes it's worse, sometimes it's less. But there is a certain anger with American foreign policy for a variety of reasons. It's in part connected to American policy toward the Arab-Israel question, in part because America is seen as part of Western domination. There are all kinds of themes that are enduring. But if you look at the cycles up and down of Arab public opinion, we saw a dramatic intensification of anger with America, mostly over the Iraq War. And what we don't understand is that it's not 9/11. I mean, people say, well, this is a post 9/11. I'm sorry, it's not a post 9/11. It's a post Iraq war. Because after 9/11, we don't have angry people with America. 9/11, after all, was an attack on American soil. It's what we did as a consequence in the name of reacting to 9/11 that has generated anger. And the Iraq war has been singularly the most important element in angering that public opinion. Why? Because 90% of the Arab public in the polls opposed the Iraq war and thought it as an intervention, unjustified, and an attempt to dominate the region. We saw that in the polls that rose. And so that anti-Americanism has added to mistrust that has made it more difficult for the U.S. to act in a credible fashion, particularly after the Arab public empowerment of the Arab uprising. So we've been facing the ramification of that deep anti-Americanism since. Connected with this is not just a perception that America is less credible in the way it acts in the Middle East, but it is also connected to the fact that we have been weakened. In reality, we have been weakened for a couple of reasons, one of which, of course, the economic costs that we have seen. The preoccupation with the war that has taken our eyes off of much more important issues, whether it was rebuilding our economy or defeating Al-Qaeda and its allies. And all of that has led to the decline in our power globally, and also the rise of competitors who are exploiting it, and certainly reassertion of Russia. And to be fair, the 1990s were in some ways an exceptional decade of American dominance. Coming out of the end of the Cold War and coming out of the Gulf War that was successful in 1991. you have an assertive America that is seen to be the sole superpower in the world, and certainly a lot of people on the defensive, including Russia after the dissolution of the Soviet Union. We find a completely different environment where objectively even the U.S. have fewer instruments of influence. It is harder to build alliances. It is harder to create an environment to act in the way we did, let's say, in the 1991 Iraq War, or even the 2003 Iraq War. So don't underestimate how much damage the 2003 Iraq War did. Whether it certainly wasn't intended that way, but that's what happened. All right, let me turn to the second big set of issues, and that is the Arab uprisings. Now, we've all seen the cycle, and I call it a cycle because, remember, a lot of people called it the Arab Spring. I never actually did call it the Arab Spring. I called it either the Arab Awakening or the Arab Uprisings, in part because I don't think it's seasonal. I think it's with us to stay, and in part because I don't think it captures what is new about these uprisings, and in part because spring gives the impression of something good immediately, and I don't think it's good or bad. I think it's complicated, and I think we need to make that assessment. So I've never used the term spring directly in my writings. You'd see if I do it, I say it in quotation mark, but I don't use it. So, but we did, if you recall, when we all witnessed the beginning of these uprisings, first in Tunisia and then in Egypt, how hopeful people were, in part because people were chanting the sort of things that resonate with us: freedom, democracy. They were mostly peaceful. They were against dictatorship. How could you not? And we've seen that in a public opinion polls that I did here in the U.S. An optimism. Alike for the Arabs, a majority of people said they like Arabs in America. Something we haven't seen historically. And so there was an embrace of that message of the Tahrir Square image that emerged. And obviously since, things have gone sour, and you have people said, who are going in a different direction, saying it's gloomy, this is the rise of extremism, it's neither. And so what is it that we're seeing? Is this just an episodic round of violence that we have witnessed in the Middle East over the years, or is this something profoundly new and different that we're witnessing? And I want to tell you that, in my own opinion, it is something profoundly new and important and consequential and enduring. But we have to understand what it is. And at the core, it's really a public empowerment on a scale we had never seen, and an empowerment at the level of individual on a scale that we had never seen, enabled by the expansion of the information revolution that happened so rapidly in the Arab world, and that is happening now even more rapidly, and it's actually accelerating, not going backward, and is likely to expand as we go, and therefore that empowerment is not going away. It's people saying, I want my voice heard. People saying, I don't believe my government because I have another source of information. People saying, I can act because they tweet and they get 1,000 people react and say, I'm hearing you and I agree with you. A certain sense of empowerment that comes with that, that you don't otherwise have in societies under authoritarianism, where there are no political groups that can connect you in a way that displays your ability to influence the system, to influence society, to influence politics. So we have something profoundly new. And if you want to grapple and understand what that means, I suggest you reflect a little bit on the impact of the Industrial Revolution in the West on society and politics. How that empowerment, which was enabled by something completely different, it wasn't the Information Revolution, it was the rise of a new economy that led to earning wages for the individual, and that individual then could assert herself or himself in the system to demand more rights at the level of society and politics in a way that has profoundly changed Western civilization but took a long time. So what we're seeing now is really a huge empowerment that people can push it back a little bit. It watches up and down. You can have reversals, but it is moving forward. No one can take it away. But here's the other side of that empowerment. A lot of people interpreted that empowerment romantically. And some of it is romantic. How could you not sort of relate to people who feel empowered individually, who want their rights, who want to speak, who want democracy, who want freedom? I certainly support it. And perhaps in the long term, one can argue it is most certainly progressive. That is, it is probably going to lead to some profound transformation of society and of politics. But in the short term, it was inevitable it was going to be destabilizing. In the medium term, it was inevitable that it was going to be destabilizing. And let me give you just a few reasons why that is the case. The first reason is that when you have public empowerment, you have weakening of central authority. I mean, number one, right? I mean, you know, what's a revolution? Or what's, you have weakened central authority. When you have weakened central authority, you have a little more anarchy. And so you have instability by default, even if people are well-meaning, right? I mean, that's an immediate, until you have something that replaces it, that is good, that's going to take some time, you're going to have more uncertainty. You're going to have more change. But more than that, the fact that you have a divided public, that you have an empowered public, doesn't mean that you have a unified public, because people don't necessarily see eye to eye. People don't necessarily want the same thing. People don't necessarily even know sometimes what they want. They know what they don't want. And so the fact that you have empowered publics is a source of division initially, not a source of harmony. Because when you're talking about, yes, if you're talking about a sectarian country, you're talking about if the Alawis are empowered, well, so are the Sunni fanatics are empowered. And so are the Christians empowered. And so are the Kurds empowered. And so everybody is empowered, but you don't need sectarianism to have divisions. Look at Egypt. Egypt is a country of nearing 90 million people, the largest in the Arab world, alone about one quarter of the Arab world. It has 10% Christians, but of the 90% who are Muslim, overwhelmingly Sunni. It has very, very few Shia. There's no Shia-Sunni divide in Egypt. And look at this incredible zero-sum divide that emerged between the elites around the military and the Muslim Brotherhood at its ally, between people who want more secular order and people who want more religious order. Look at what happened in the parliamentary elections when, yes, the liberals were empowered. You had people who were pro-Western, who were outspoken, who wanted total freedom, and this ultra-conservative Salafis suddenly come out of the woodwork, and they're a force to be reckoned with, getting over a quarter of the vote in parliamentary elections. So the fact that you have public empowerment and a new rules of the game for them to compete doesn't mean they're going to see eye to eye. They're going to compete with each other. That's what we're seeing in almost every country. And remind you again, you don't need sectarianism to have divisions. We just are lured by that notion as an easy answer to something far more complex. And we should resist that very much. Also, the fact that you have a state weakened and that the public is empowered, even if you have a unified public, it's never the case that the public is the only force that determines politics. I mean, think about us. We're a mature democracy. And who says that our public opinion determines our policy? Certainly we all count a little bit electorally, and we matter. But look at how our politics plays itself out. Look at lobbies. Look at multinational corporations. Look at political parties. Look at all those forces in society that weigh in. To think that I have the same power as someone who will vote in the election as someone who is contributing $100 million of their money for the campaign process is a joke. I mean, it's a real joke. And I'm not saying that to dismiss our democracy. I don't know a better one, to be honest. So, you know, I think we're all talking in relative terms, but even in our mature democracy, the public matters more, yes, than in other societies, but it's not the determining factor in politics. And what happens is that these countries, of course, are not even democracies. They may aspire to be, some of them may aspire to be, but they're in transition. And so what happens to those other forces that had controlled the power before? Whether they're government bureaucracies that still want their jobs and they still control a lot of aspects of life. Are they going to go away and say, you know, I'm going to listen? What happens to the military, which is important in every one of these Arab countries that was decisive in every outcome that happened from Tunisia to Egypt to Syria? Are these people going to say, we're going to step aside and not have power in society and give up what we have? Of course not. So they all adjust. They all try to learn. They all say, we have a new game. The public is empowered. We have to accept that, but we have to find a way to assert our influence. So you ultimately end up having a new rules, but more competition, not less competition. Finally, the third point I want to make with regard to public empowerment is we do know that when you have those kind of transitions that I described, where you have more divisions and more uncertainty and uncertain rules of the game and a diminished central authority, where central authority simply is less able to provide security and less able to provide food, you often have a backlash where the more desperate the situation gets with security and economic depravity, the more people are willing to listen again to dictators. And you have a backlash, or to rally behind a tough central authority that promised them at least to bring them security and food, even at the expense of the democracy they were calling for 2 years ago. We saw that in Egypt, how the backlash against the Brotherhood is, I want my family safe, I want food on the table, and I'll deal with the rest later. So you're going to have these cycles of, and this is not just true of the Middle East. Look at, you know, we have a lot of literature dealing with transitions from authoritarianism that deals with this when we have these cycles of reversals. But regardless of these reversals, that major impetus that I talked to you about, the public empowerment that is driving this, is not going to go away. People will take a breather. People will step back a little bit. People will give a little more space to rulers to provide. But that force is with us to stay. And the way it's going to play itself out is going to vary from country to country based on the ability of the governments to address it, based on the makeup of every country, and based on also the availability of resources. So we have witnessing all of that in much of the Arab world at the moment. I just want to make one final comment before I end on the Israeli-Arab conflict. At the moment, the Israeli-Arab conflict in some ways is not at the center stage even in the Middle East, in part because you can see that Egyptians are worried about what's happening to them in daily lives, and Syrians have to worry literally about their own survival, and Iraqis the same. And so the Israel-Palestine issue, which has been historically an issue through which Arabs viewed the world, I call it the prism of pain throughout that decade, through which Arabs evaluated American foreign policy, and it still is psychologically linked to who Arabs are, how what their identity is, even subconsciously, even we not even focus on it. It has been not so much in the center of attention, but in part, it hasn't been in the center of attention because we haven't seen direct conflict except what we've seen in Gaza war, and then the focus goes into it. You could see it in the coverage of the press, for example. And I think this conflict has the potential of being a further complicating factor in the coming months and years, in large part not so much because of its complexity and the way it connects to the region and, frankly, to us, because people see America as Israel's empowerer and through that through that prism, their evaluation of American foreign policy is inevitably linked to their anger with Israel over the Arab-Israeli conflict. So it's connected. But beyond that, I think what we're seeing historically is that the two-state solution, which has been the focal point of American diplomacy, international diplomacy, and Arab-Israeli negotiations, is coming to an end. We find too many people on all sides of the equation who think it's too late for it. I poll among Israeli Jews, among Israeli Arabs, among Palestinians, among Arabs outside the West Bank and Gaza, and I have now majorities say that it'll never happen. It'll never happen. And when you say it'll never happen, then people think you're a fool if you compromise before a conflict emerges or give up any of your cards, and it makes it impossible for governments to move forward toward that end. More importantly, of course, the facts on the ground are changing so dramatically in the West Bank through the settlement policy, including East Jerusalem, in a way that is making it very hard to see how you can really have a viable and contiguous Palestinian state that is independent. It certainly still is a hope of American foreign policy that that would be the case, and it remains the focal point of diplomacy. But frankly, so many people are walking away from it that it is very difficult to know that we can even persuade anyone unless we do something dramatic that is unlikely to happen. And so for that reason, I think even when you poll Israelis and Arabs about that conflict and say, so what would happen if there's no two-state solution? The majority say there will be violence for years to come, or the status quo will continue. Very few people think there will be another solution. And I think that is a realistic assessment by the public that could certainly be exploited by the groups that are expanding in the militancy in the Middle East to pull the Arab-Israeli conflict into this broader contestation that has taken place in the region, including the rise of ISIS. Now, are you depressed enough? You have reason to be, and I, you know, people ask me, are you a pessimist or an optimist about the Middle East? I say I'm a realist, in some ways, I wouldn't describe myself as a pessimist, and let me tell you why, for two reasons. One is an issue I talked about earlier, which is when you look at the Arab uprisings and in the short term you see how complicated and terrifying it is, particularly for people who live there. I mean, let's not forget that people are paying a price every single day. I mean, look at Syria and Iraq and everywhere that there is where there is bloodshed. People are dying. People are terrified, and young children. It is a miserable state of affairs. I sit back and I look at it, putting on a historical perspective, and I see trends that are ultimately, in my own opinion, or at least I feel deeply, ultimately progressive. And so that's one reason why I sort of keep this historical perspective. But the second thing, particularly having to do with the Israel-Palestine question, where there doesn't seem to be an answer, and there is no obvious leadership that could break the deadlock, and there is no obvious end to this game in the immediate future. And then I take my scholar's hat off for a minute, and I look at I use the hat of just a human observer of events, and I notice the following. I notice that when I look at every major change that has happened in recent memory, whether it's at the global level or at the level of the Middle East, whether it was the dissolution of the Soviet Union, the end of the Cold War, whether it was in the Middle East, things like the 1973 Arab-Israeli War, or the peace treaty between Egypt and Israel and Sadat going to Jerusalem, or Yasser Arafat shaking hands with Yitzhak Rabin on the White House lawn, in 19, 93. If you take any of these and I ask you to look at the discourse about what's happening, you'll find no one predicted them. And everyone before was pessimistic where there's optimism, or optimistic where there was need for pessimism. And that is because what we don't fully understand is that when we are looking at genuine change in history, genuine change is inherently unpredictable. Why I say it's inherently unpredictable? Because in our thinking about what is a scientific method of analysis, what is a social scientific method of analysis, how do we present a prediction? If you ask me now, could you predict what will happen? What is a scientific prediction other than looking at the patterns of the past and applying them to the future? Because what we do when we analyze what is likely to happen is look at patterns of what had happened, identify those patterns, and then extend them into the future. What is change if it's not a break from those patterns? What is profound change if it's not inherently the break from those patterns? And so we don't have that. And so therefore, I'm not optimistic and I'm not pessimistic. I'm a realist. And don't interpret that to be pessimism. Thank you very much.
You think you've depressed us, but if you look at the last 2 years of our speakers, you know that we're undepressible. We've had no good news in the last 2 years. I have a bunch of questions. Well, you teased us a little bit. You said you see something ultimately progressive about what's happening. What do you see? We'd love to know what that is.
Well, again, I look at it, if you want to put that hat on, again, think about Western civilization and think about the destabilizing impact of the Industrial Revolution. And if you lived through part of it and you had an orderly life and, cultural norms and codes, societal norms and codes, and a certain understanding of the distribution of power in society, and you're comfortable with it, and the disruption is always very destabilizing. Sometimes it is bloody and contentious. But if you look at where that public empowerment is, meaning that ultimately individuals are going to have more say, ultimately we're going to have less authoritarianism. Ultimately, I think we have a progressive move away from that. Ultimately, I think we're going to have more women empowerment, despite ISIS. ISIS will fail. ISIS will fail. ISIS will ultimately fail because it's just not. It is the antithesis. It is the antithesis of the individual empowerment, and it will fail. And that's the source of optimism. And it's a historical view. It's not a view that they will fail tomorrow. It's not a view that will fail in a year. It is a view that 10 years from now, they will have been declared a failure. And that is a source of optimism.
Thank you. I've got way too many questions for you to answer in the time available to us. So I'm going to focus on the ones that have to do with your work in the surveys and understanding of the Arab mind and how the world looks to the Arabs. You told us very persuasively what the effect of the Iraq intervention was, but how about the Gulf War of 1991? How did that go down with the Arab Street?
When I went to the Middle East before and when I watched the reaction after, I heard from a lot of people, including the Iraqi officials, including Yasser Arafat, the PLO chief, whom I met then in Baghdad, arranged by April Glaspie, secretly, because we were not supposed to be talking to him at that time. They were all focused on public opinion and what public opinion was supposed to be, and they were focused on how it's driving some of the decisions, including the Iraqi decisions. When we then tried to put the coalition together to dislodge Iraq from Kuwait, One exception to the rule was the King of Jordan, who was not only our ally, but was our closest ally. He was the most dependent ruler in the Arab world on the United States of America. And maybe more than that, as some people know here in the field. He stood to lose so much by going against the U.S. and also against his bankers from the Gulf. And yet he decided to go against and not support the coalition and stick with Saddam Hussein in a way that alienated everyone else, including the Israelis, with whom he kept a relationship. And the reason for it was that he thought his public opinion was so adamantly opposed to this that he stood the chance to lose his crown, and he'd rather lose the aid than lose his crown. And public opinion mattered. And that really is what drove me ultimately to study public opinion. And I wrote an article that has been influential in one of the journals right after the war called Arab Public Opinion in the Gulf War. So yes, it was a factor in that war. But as I said in that article then, and I say now, it was much more divided, in large part because if you were focused on the Israel-Palestine question, you were much more angry with the U.S. If you're focused on the Gulf, if you're a member of the GCC, of Saudi Arabia, or the UAE, and you're worried about the consequences of Iraqi invasion of Kuwait, you're far more prepared to listen to the U.S. If you're farther away in North Africa, you had mixed feelings. So it was much more complicated than the 2003 war.
Well, we have a bunch of questions here, more or less on the theme, does the United States ever do anything right as viewed from the Arab world? Can you think of things that we have done, policy initiatives that the U.S. has undertaken that have played well, and let's say in the last 15 years?
Well, if you look at particularly, you know, since the Obama administration came to office, if you look at his initial effort, particularly the first year, where he tried to reframe the relationship between the U.S. and Muslim-majority countries in the Middle East, where he tried to reduce the sense of a clash of civilization, as represented in some of his speeches in Turkey, Egypt, and to Iran. Those were welcomed, and they had an impact for much of that year. If I look at what happened with him, is that, and by the way, I was there in the White House when they were preparing for the speech in Cairo, and I gave my input on it. And one of the things I said was that you only have a honeymoon of about 6 months because it's all about credibility. And if you don't deliver, if you promise too much and you don't deliver, it doesn't matter. They don't like you just because you're Barack Obama. And we had the polls to indicate that, that they didn't like him because he was, quote, an African-American, or because all of this sense that people have does not show up in the polls at all. So I think they did that well. I think he was defeated by the Israel-Palestine question.
Not the first one to be defeated by that.
And that defeat that first year had huge consequences on him. But let's be fair to him. And where we have to be fair is that if you look at the emergence of the Arab uprisings just a little over a year after he's been in office, no one could have predicted those, and those really reshuffled the priorities and made it very difficult for anybody to manage. And I happen to think that the first couple of years, the administration actually handled the Arab uprisings relatively well. By saying relatively well, remember, this is not us to control. There's nothing we could have done. Don't measure it against some, you know, better outcome. Measure it against how even it could have been worse for the U.S. And I think the president's instinct in that handling was right initially, which was don't make this about America. They're now engaged in a competition with each other, societal competition. Don't insert yourself in a way where you are the focal point. Number two, we don't know how to state build. We haven't shown that we're capable of doing it, at least in the Middle East. And number three, certainly we can't do it through the use of force, and we haven't done it before. And don't be tempted to be dragged into it because somebody is calling on you to do so. And all of that actually showed itself in some of the polling that we did early on, where actually the administration didn't do too badly a year after the Arab uprisings in terms of evaluation. Not that it was positive, but it was certainly better than the year before. I think now, because it's a polarized region, and there is a historical mistrust of the United States, and there is, you know, no belief that whatever we do, even if we do something for simply humanitarian reasons, if we intervene in Syria just to save lives, if we intervene in Iraq just to save the Yazidis, they'll never trust that we're doing it for the right reason. They think we're doing it for imperialistic reason. And for that reason, it's very easy for people, particularly the more we're involved, it's very easy for both sides of the equation to blame the U.S. So the Muslim Brotherhood blames us for the coup. They blame us. They say that Sisi took over because of American support, and the Muslim Brotherhood calls it a coup. We find that the Egyptian military says that we're actually helping the Muslim Brotherhood, that we're not supporting them enough. So we have this kind of competition, and that plays itself in the public discourse because people don't trust the U.S., so they use the U.S. to justify their positions.
Jessica Matthews has observed of the Carnegie Endowment for World Peace that ISIS presents an interesting opportunity in that it brings together Saudi Arabia and Iran and much of the Shia world and the U.S. and Israel as an anti-ISIS bloc. Could this be exploited in some way?
Theoretically, yes. But here's the thing. We all know the rule of thumb, which is the enemy of my enemy is my friend. And it's a question of who's seen as the bigger enemy. And in Iraq, the reason why ISIS has influence, it isn't because people embrace its crazy agenda. I mean, we've looked at polling. People don't embrace this fanatical world order that they're advocating. People don't want a Taliban-like state in Iraq. People think that is not what they want for their children. So they're not embracing that. So why do they support them? They support them because they think they want to liberate themselves from what they see as, for now, a Shia-dominated government. They feel like the Sunnis have been marginalized. They want to have a voice. They bandwagon behind any force that is capable of getting them there. And so despite what you see, it isn't that ISIS has enemies necessarily across the board in the public because they will support them not because they love them, but because they're going to deliver something that they don't have. And when you look at governments, it's true that governments have more incentive to collaborate on this issue because the ISIS is a threat to the Saudis. But the Saudis also don't want to see a Shia-dominated government in Iraq. They don't want to see an expansion of Iranian influence. The Turks are saying, we don't like ISIS, but what you're doing is you're rewarding Assad, and we don't like Assad either, and we don't want to be part of something that will empower Assad. So we have this complicated set of circumstances to begin with. But what makes it worse is up until the time when we made a decision to intervene by air, ISIS said that their priority is Arab rulers, not the U.S. In that sense, they were very different from Al-Qaeda. And they had a fight over this with Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda said, our focus is America. They said, no, our focus is Arab rulers or Muslim rulers. They don't differentiate. And their fight is local. So they weren't focused so much on the U.S. And then we go against them, and suddenly America is part of the fight. So here's what happens. Is the King of Jordan that we now expect, he would be fighting this full force, and he wants to. This is a threat to him. The King of Jordan I worry about most. And I think that they have some segments of the public that are very sympathetic with ISIS. So we go and we're trying to build a coalition. And read the Jordanian discourse right now. Everybody's saying to the king, don't you dare join America's war. And I'm not talking about ISIS. I'm not even talking about the Muslim Brotherhood. I'm talking about some of the secular leftist opposition, which is don't join the war, America's war on ISIS. So the way to get them to act is to make it their issue, not turn it into ours. And I think we're making a mistake by raising our profile in the fight.
Well, to end, we like to have a softball question, one that you could answer with an optimistic answer. What is likely to happen to Israel and the Palestinians? That's not it, is it? Through the years, how has the attitude around women in the Arab world evolved?
This is really a good question, and I think I study the woman issue, and those of you who looked at a copy of my book, there is a chapter in which I look at the role of women as well as the role of religion and democracy, sort of more of a social issue. And I have to tell you that it's not easy to capture that directly, because a lot of people, when you say, do you support women's rights? Everybody says, yes, of course, but what is women's rights, right? So they're going to interpret it the way they think, whether, you know, so they have interpretation. So to me, as a scholar, I think the most important attitude that I tried to measure was far more practical, which is, do you believe that women have the right to work outside the home? No, because that is, to me, employment and earning wages is the best path to empowerment, the best path to getting equality in society and politics. And so it's a question of whether you have loosened societal norms that allow women to go out there and earn wages. And what I found, interestingly, is far more receptivity than I even expected. I had only about less than 25% across the board, including in Saudi Arabia, people who say women should never work outside the home. I had another quarter who say women should always have the right to work outside the home. But the bulk, the about half, varies a little bit from country to country, say women should have the right to work outside the home when economically needed, which is almost always right now. And we see that, as I was talking at dinner last night about a visit I had to a women's college in Saudi Arabia. And by the way, talking about trends, put aside the employment for a moment. When you go into the conservative societies of the Gulf region, and they are the most conservative on women's issues, especially Saudi Arabia, and you go to colleges, obviously they're women's colleges, or if there is a co-ed college, segregation. What you have is more women college students than men college students, just like we have here. In fact, a higher ratio of women to men. So women are getting an education. And even more inspiring is that there are more women studying physics and math and engineering than we have in this country. So they're going not just into, you know, history or Islam, you know, or things of that sort, but they're going into the hard sciences where we don't have, even here, we've had a problem in our colleges attracting women. But the real question is what they do with it afterwards. Do they then go home and become an educated wife or daughter, or do they actually get a job and then they have more say on politics? And the trend, I think, is toward employment. And in that visit to the Saudi college in the Dhahran region in Saudi Arabia, I asked the director what women do. She said a lot of them do get jobs or become entrepreneurs. And I said, but how does society look at it? And she said, it's interesting, the middle class is changing dramatically, where a woman with a job is now a better candidate for marriage. And if you want a note to be optimistic about, that is a note to be optimistic about. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Appreciate it.